How powerful is the Cox Network? So powerful that one day, the internet will let your doctor perform miracles from thousands of miles away.
Connecting to remote operating room.
Giving a whole new meaning to the term house call.
Operation complete.
The Cox Network. With gig speeds everywhere, it's internet built for tomorrow, today. Cox, bringing us closer. In Cox serviceable areas, speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms apply. Other restrictions may apply.
Is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome David McCloskey, the author of a work of fiction, a novel, Damascus Station. It is a story of intrigue involving state security in the United States, state security in the Middle East, especially Syrian state security, Mukhbarat. However, this is based upon historical events that in these last years have become more and more tragic. So we begin with David's presentation of the conditions where he puts his characters in and asks them to solve puzzles that are still unavailable to all of us in the tragedy of the darkness visible of Syria. Millions have fled. Hundreds of thousands may be dead. Assad remains at the palace in Damascus. This is a story of what was possible early in the turmoil, early in the collapse of Syrian sovereignty. David, congratulations and a very good evening to you. Your hero, protagonist, Sam Joseph, is a CIA officer, covert officer. He is plunged into the conditions in Syria. He knows this very well. He's a veteran. So let us introduce what Sam knows he's up against when he arrives in Damascus at the CIA operations in Damascus. Bashar al-Assad, what is he as your novel opens, and what is his ambition, his contest as your novel opens? Good day to you, David.
John, thank you so much for having me. Great to be here talking with everyone and you about Damascus Station. The book starts in page one. It says it's the early years of the Syrian uprising, which is really when I looked at this as an analyst at the CIA. And, you know, it's a work of fiction. There's not a year on there, but this is really looking at the world of Syria, the CIA, the Middle East, from about 2011 to 2013, which is when, we had the beginnings of a protest movement in Syria. We had the initial spark of kind of insurgency. We had the beginnings of state crackdown and eventually sort of full-on counterinsurgency against this opposition. And the main players that I introduce into this book are, on the one hand, the CIA, keen to understand what's going on inside the palace, how Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, is thinking about the unrest, what he plans to do to suppress it. And on the other hand, really the Syrian regime, which I paint the picture of that palace and its, you know, security apparatus through the eyes of several characters in this novel, one of whom is Sam's eventual recruit, Miriam Haddad, who's a kind of ambivalent palace official who is trying to do her job, but also very frustrated and angry about family being mistreated, not uncommon in Syria at the time. And also through the eyes of several Syrian security officials, one named Ali Hassan, who is also an ambivalent sort of former police detective focused on cracking down on the, you know, the protesters, finding spies. And so I really wanted to paint, I think, in the, you know, the story of this novel, a scene of a country, the city, Damascus itself, sort of on the verge of the fall right before it tipped over into full-on state collapse.
Yes, it begins in 2011, coterminous with the Arab Spring. It might be a result of the Arab Spring, but that isn't critical. What is to understand Bashar al-Assad, trained as an ophthalmologist, married to a fashionable woman, and as comfortable in Paris as he is anywhere else in the world. And yet the man you present in the course of the novel, who survives and continues, is as bloody-minded as we can imagine Djougashvili Stalin was once upon a time. You've presented a genuine force of nature. You've also presented the fact that Bashar al-Assad makes at least one phone call to Vladimir Putin. What do we need to know about the relationship between Moscow and Damascus?
Yeah, I did have a lot of fun putting the real Bashar al-Assad, a fictional interpretation of him, and Vladimir Putin into this book to have a little bit of fun at their expense, which they so richly deserve. The Russians and Syrians have a longstanding relationship that goes back to well into the Cold War, when Syria was a client state. They purchased most of their military equipment from Moscow. They were firmly in the Soviet camp during the Cold War. That tailored off a bit, obviously, or tapered off a bit during the 90s. But as Bashar consolidated power in the early 2000s after his father died and he took the reins in Syria, the Russians, and especially as the Arab Spring erupted and his rule was challenged, the Russians saw him as a way to achieve some very specific objectives in the Middle East. They wanted access to a warm water port on the Mediterranean. They now have that. They wanted to prop him up as a way to, contest with us globally because we were opposed to him. And as a result, the personal relationship between Putin and between Assad, most people don't think is particularly close. There are, deep strategic reasons why the Russians have invested so heavily in the Syrians over the past 10 years, and certainly in the past five or six or so, when they, underwent a more full-throated military intervention that, by most accounts, probably saved the regime from collapsing in 2015 and 2016.
Complicating this is the fact that these are historical events. They're dim in my memory, but we lived through them without any clarity. And you were an analyst at the CIA, and you knew what the fog of war is. So I add one more complication. During this period between the Arab Spring, 2011, and 2013, when the question of Assad using WMD, the U.S. left Iraq. The decision was to leave Iraq. And then again, the decision by the executive was to confront Assad over his use of WMD. And the president was Barack Obama in this period. And he's presented as a man making decisions that are helpful to the CIA, but have their limits, always their limits. What do you want us to understand about the interest of the U.S. involved in all this? I understand it's virtuous to protect people from sarin gas. But in any event, how were we entangled in this period? How was the U.S. entangled with Assad, with eventually Putin? And then, of course, we could go around, ring around the world of the Middle East. What was our interest, David? What national security interest?
Yeah, well, I think early on in the Arab Spring, when regimes were sort of tottering all around the region, Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, Libya, all of this was happening at the same time as Syria. And there was a sense, I think, on the part of many in the administration at the time, that the fall of Assad was inevitable. It was not a matter of if, it was a matter of when, and that when was thought to be fairly short. So as a result, made a lot of rhetorical statements about how he should go. And that was the, right thing for U.S. policy. It was the right thing sort of, from a values standpoint, that Assad stepped down and allow a political transition to occur. When that didn't happen, we began to explore as a government options to support opposition against him. And when that opposition didn't really materialize in a unified, coherent way, the opposition to him has always been fairly head up, particularly in that period, very fragmented. We were on the one hand left with, statements around how he should go, warnings about not using chemical weapons for fear that that would create precedent in other places that they could be used. And then on the other hand, this sort of, I would say less than full throated support for the opposition emerging against him. And so when sarin was used in dramatic fashion in 2013, and by the way, it had been used at a very small scale starting in 2012. But when it was used in massive scale in 2013, we were sort of stuck with this problem whereby we had a tremendous gap between where our rhetoric was and between the resources that we were truly willing as a country to commit to achieve the objectives that we had set out for ourselves. And I think whenever you have that kind of gap, it's a recipe for policy disaster. And I think that is what unspooled when we decided not to respond in at least some kind of punitive way to the use of chemical weapons in August of 2013.
One more historical figure in the book that is not present but referred to, Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father. You make very clear that this scale of massacre has happened before in Syria. You talk about the massacre in 1980s and the tribal warfare in Syria between the Alawites, the minority that the Assad family represents, the Christians, the Sunnis, and eventually al-Qaeda crowds in, the jihadists. So what we're dealing with here is a battleground state. Is that correct, David? That's the way you want the reader to understand it. This state has been at war for a long time.
Well, I think that is certainly true over the past 10 years in the way that this protest movement and then insurgency and then civil war has developed. The state, though, previously went through an insurgency, as you mentioned, in the early 80s, which was fought between largely the kind of militant wing of the Muslim Brotherhood in the country, Sunni Muslims, and the largely Alawite-dominated security apparatus and military led by the Assad family. That was suppressed violently in 1982. It was put down. And in the intervening period from the mid-80s until the Arab Spring, the state was not at war, but the state was not sort of put together politically in the way that we would think most countries, most healthy or stable countries would be. It's a, country that was led by a very authoritarian regime that sort of managed a divide and rule strategy amongst the population. It had a highly repressive security apparatus, and it was a very patchwork country, similar in many respects to places like Iraq and Lebanon, where you had Alawites, 10% of the population, Christians were 10% of the population, Kurds were 10% or so of the population, Sunni Arabs made up the remainder. So you had this very patchwork, society from an ethnic and religious standpoint that when the Arab Spring began, made it challenging as sort of state authority weakened to maintain control of the entire entity.
I'm speaking to David McCloskey, a former analyst at the CIA for the Middle East, but now a novelist. And the new work of fiction is Damascus Station. This is the story of the CIA. And when we come back, we're going to tell what we want to. Just a very limited amount of the setup of this thriller. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
How powerful is the Cox Network? So powerful that one day, the internet will let your doctor perform miracles from thousands of miles away.
Connecting to remote operating room.
Giving a whole new meaning to the term house call.
Operation complete.
The Cox Network. With gig speeds everywhere, it's internet built for tomorrow, today. Cox, bringing us closer. In Cox serviceable areas, speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms apply. Other restrictions may apply.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.